Welcome to Near and Far, the World Catholicism Podcast. I'm your host, Bill Cavanaugh, Director of the Center for World Catholicism and Intercultural Theology at DePaul University in Chicago.
Welcome to Near and Far. My name is Michael Budde, and I am a Senior Research Professor in the Center for World Catholicism and Intercultural Theology at DePaul University in Chicago. We're here for this conversation on the eve of the most important holiday on the calendar in the United States. Not Christmas, not Easter, not Ramadan or Yom Kippur, but the Super Bowl, the culmination of American football, a sport of limited worldwide participation and declining youth participation even in the United States, drew 115 million domestic viewers in 2023, making it the most popular TV program in American history. Advertisers pay $7 million U.S. dollars to put themselves before this audience for all of 30 seconds. Approximately 68 million people, nearly one in four people in the United States, will place a wager on this game, legally or illegally. The total amount of wagering is expected to total somewhere around $23 billion in 2024. There are home parties, neighborhood gatherings, public events featuring food, drink, and entertainment. Like other secular holidays, there are carefully observed rituals, pregame practices, a gala halftime music performance, lavish tributes to American military power, endless commentary on matters before, during, and after the feature athletic performance. But we're not here to talk about the Super Bowl. We're here to talk about sports more broadly, while more specifically talking about sports and their place in a Catholic perspective on life. With me today is Professor James J. Carney, Jay to his friends, Associate Professor of Theology at Creighton University, a Jesuit university in Omaha, Nebraska. He directs the university's Christian Spirituality Program and is an expert in African Catholic theology. His interests range widely, and we've invited him to talk about his latest book. It's entitled On the Eighth Day, A Catholic Theology of Sport, published by Cascade Publishing. It's a thoughtful and engaging exploration of a long-standing relationship, Catholicism and play, leisure, and the like, that's unknown to many people. As we'll explore in our conversation, sports, its problems and possibilities, are also a main concern of Pope Francis, and Jay sheds light on why the Pope sees sports as such an important part of human society, one worthy of serious Christian engagement. Hello, Jay. Welcome to Near and Far.
Thank you, Mike. It's great to be with you, and great to be here at DePaul.
Why don't we start with you explaining a bit how you came to write about Catholicism and sports? There are a lot of other topics one could write about, and you've written about many of them, but why sports?
Thanks, Mike. To first address this question, sometimes with my students, I'll joke on the first day of class. And just to put this, since we're on a podcast, I'm around 5'9", maybe 155. I don't have the most illustrious athletic background, but I'll often say, you know, this started when I was an All-American linebacker at Alabama. The coaches would ask, you know, Carney, you're so religious and you're so athletic. No. So to be honest, I grew up playing sports, particularly soccer and tennis. Been a fan my whole life, at times maybe too much. My wife actually says, as I've gotten older, I've mellowed, you know, I don't have emotional breakdowns when my beloved Arkansas Razorbacks lose. But honestly, the impetus for this book came out of teaching. And my colleague, who I co-authored the book On the Eighth Day that you mentioned, his name Max Engel. He's a good friend and colleague of mine at Creighton. And Max approached me, this was probably in 2015-16, and said, you know, we have a whole generation of students, particularly young men, but also many young women, who love sport. They love sport a lot more than religion, right? And there's a lot of human experience that's going on in this. He wanted to put a course proposal together. So Max is a good friend of mine, and I did have some implicit interest in this. So we put a joint course together that we team taught for a few years called Sport and Spirituality. And we found in the class that, yeah, students really came alive talking about their sport experience, but we also realized that that is not without its ambiguity. And the more we listen to these predominantly freshman students, there's a lot of pain, there's a lot of corruption, there's a lot of suffering. And then there's also just tremendous hope and, you know, team experience growth. But we realized in teaching the course that while there's some great articles, there's some great first person testimonies of athletes and coaches, we just weren't finding quite the intersection of a more kind of sophisticated but still student accessible theology in sport. And so the book grew out of teaching that course, working with our friend Matt Hoven, who we've known for years, works up at St. Albert's in Edmonton, Canada, and has worked in the area of sports and religion for years. And so some of this also came out of friendship. We're good friends. We all teach in this area. We sat down and said, let's do this. So we put the joint book together. It was really a pleasure to write it. We predominantly wrote it during the pandemic.
You make a point in the book that I thought was engaging, where you suggest that this might be an unusually good time in the life of the church and in many of the cultures in which the church exists to explore some of these kinds of issues, that there's a confluence of a lot of different interests and dynamics and so on that maybe make this a particularly worthwhile time to push into some of these things. Can you talk about some of the context in which this seems like a good idea?
Sure. In some ways that your question takes us back 150 years, and the books on the intersection of modern sport and Christianity often have chapters like the church goes to the playground or the church enters the pitch, you know, another kind of, yeah. And because really going back to, you know, to do a longer history more briefly, the early modern attitudes, particularly in Protestant America towards sport, were pretty negative. And it was really like sport's going to corrupt people. Sport corrupts the Sabbath. The Puritans were pretty anti-sport. But by the mid-19th century, you see the rise of intercollegiate athletics, more professional sport. By the late 19th century, things are really booming. I mean, in the year 1900, there were 20 million fans going to baseball games, if I recall that. You know, there was a game between Yale and Harvard that had 90,000 fans, right? So this was in the 1890s. So there's this huge phenomenon. And I think Christians resisted that, like they often do, and then they capitulate, right? So, and part of what I think our book does is to say, okay, complete resistance isn't helpful, right? And there's good things in this world of sport. There's a reason people are attracted. But the complete capitulation is also problematic, and you get these kinds of extreme things in the early 1900s of, you know, popular writers talking about Jesus, the little scrapper, and how, you know, if he was a boxer, he would have laid the 1-2, you know, like put him down. Apparently, they read the Passion narrative differently than any I've seen. But, so with that, so in some ways, the moment you speak of has been a longer historical moment. I do think in the 21st century, sport is a big business. Obviously, we have NIL, which has fundamentally transformed college sport.
For people outside the United States, what does NIL?
Sure, yeah. So NIL is name, image, and likeness, and it allows university athletes to profit personally off the usage of their name, image, or likeness in merchandising and marketing. So the school is not paying them directly, but they can make money. So for college athletes that, in fairness, sometimes we're undercompensated now. For example, at Creighton, which is my university, this is unofficial, but we likely have a player making over $1 million this year in NIL money.
And this is in the otherwise amateur world.
Right, you know, right. These are supposed to be amateur athletes.
Student athletes.
Right. So I think, the sport offers this very, very rich horizon. You know, if you look at the inverse charts of religious participation over the last 150 years, it generally come down in the Western world. Sport participation's gone up. But in many parts of the global South, you know, religion and sport engagement have gone up together. But I think it calls for the church to have a sense of openness and engagement because it matters so much, particularly to young people, but also to have a critical eye. And what we talk a lot about in the book is that sport works best when it doesn't become its own religion, it doesn't become its own idol, but when it's harnessed to a broader vision of the human person within a Christian gospel framework.
I want to go back to something you said, because I think it's one of the real strengths of the book. I opened our conversation with a reference to a distinctly U.S. sporting phenomenon, that being the Super Bowl of American football. But one of the things I appreciated most about your book is its worldwide reach. Mm. You know, I mean, in what way are the questions and problems similar in these multiple contexts that you explore and that you've studied in your other labors, and what things are distinctive to times and places?
Sure.
That are not, you know, easily transposed.
So, yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, sport is obviously a global phenomenon. My family and I had a great opportunity before the pandemic to live in Uganda for a year where I was doing research and teaching. And I was struck that in a world that can be deeply, and it may be appropriately so, anti-colonial, there is still like tremendous passion for English Premiership fan clubs. And so, I mean, if you want to have a fight in a Ugandan bar, you know, get your Man United fan club and your Arsenal fan club together. And it's just, it's like this weird sort of neo-colonial, but it's also the globalization of sport, and you have a remarkable number of African athletes in Europe who are there. I mean, more recently, the primary challenger to Felix Tshisekedi in Congo is Moise Tshombe. He's the owner of the most successful soccer club coming out of Katanga in southern Congo. So yeah, this intersection of sport, money, the passion of youth, also opportunity, you know, people, and this can be a problem. I mean, often sports seen as the way out to the point that it can become exploitative. So yeah, I think all these, you don't see the same, at least in where I lived in East Africa, the same infrastructure around college sport. You do, of course, have local professional clubs. But yeah, definitely a global phenomenon. And what struck me also is with the, you could say, the growth of communications technology and media, like the world really is small. And so I remember one time, this was on another trip when I was in Rwanda and I was speaking at a school. And so I get through and talk about myself, and this kid raises his hand. He says, "Do you know Kobe Bryant?"
Yeah.
And he had like a Kobe Bryant shirt. And I was like, "I don't know him." You know, I sometimes think I do because I hear about him so much. But so it's also interesting, for example, NBA basketball and the predominance of Black athletes is also social movers. That has a lot of influence I've seen in Africa. So,
well, that was part of the David Stern legacy, the NBA Africa program.
That's right.
It built, you started to put in some of the infrastructure for developmental leagues in basketball across the subcontinent.
Right, exactly. So yeah, so most sports, I mean, even baseball is now, you know, incredibly international. American football, when we start with the Super Bowl, I still think struggles the most. It's just so uniquely American. And it's always funny. I mean, I do think there's this pretension, like the NFL's going to play a game in Brazil next year. And I just kind of laugh. It's like, be who you are. You're an American sport. I mean, why are you trying to, like, we're going to have a team in London? I mean, come on. And but beyond football, American football, I think almost all sports are incredibly international now. So
one of the most important aspects of your work is the extent to which sports constitutes what you call a formative process for both individuals and communities. What do you mean when you talk about sports as formative, and why is that a category that's both theologically and sociologically interesting?
Sure, thank you. So in the theory, in the tradition of virtue ethics, which to break that down for folks who may not know, virtue ethics has deep roots both in Greek philosophy, but also in Catholic philosophy. And it really argues that we're formed by what we do. We're formed by our habits. We're formed by how we live our life each day. And so ethics is always, it's about a way of life as much as it is about some sort of, you know, decision in a difficult circumstance. And I think if you look at young people's lives, even sometimes older people, what's forming them every day is sport. I mean, growing up, I had a young woman I was friends with who was a swimmer, and she would be up at 5 a.m., 4:30 a.m. every day. Now, if she was getting up at 4:30 a.m. to go pray the rosary, you know, people would say she's a crazy religious zealot, and they think it's weird. But people do this for sport all the time. And there, I mean, there's this whole, including in places like Illinois and Indiana, there's a huge growth of sports complex towns where they're just building out in farmlands and creating sports fields because families take vacations all the time to go to sports tournaments. And so, you know, for better or for worse, sports are forming people. It's often what kids are spending the most time doing. Parents are spending the most money on. The coach is often next to the parents, the most formative moral influence. And so part of what we try to do in the book is not to dodge it or just to sort of denigrate it, but also not to say, as sometimes can be a facile response, like, well, sport will just form them. they'll just become virtuous. It's like, no, that's not, that doesn't necessarily happen. And you have to be intentional and think about, okay, how are we actually forming these young people? And I think the Catholic tradition would have a distinctive voice on that. So
I think that kind of easy assumption that you poked a little bit of fun at there makes a lot more sense if you're talking about a culture that at least has this sort of thin veneer of religiosity that already presupposes a compatibility of identities and allegiances between God and country and your place in society and so on, that they're all seamless and there are never any conflicts between them.
Right.
So, you know, whether it's a fellowship of athletes that just, you know, you just want to get right with Jesus, and then both your career and your family life and everything is going to just just be swell.
Right. That's right.
That a Catholic sensibility has a little more gravel under it than some of those earlier experiences.
Right. That's a very good point. So
you draw from a great many important voices in the past and the present of Christianity. Did any of them surprise you in how their concerns resonated with what you and your colleagues were
sure.
trying to explore or get a handle on?
I was not surprised I have a graduate degree in church history, so I wasn't surprised that Tertullian was so irascible. Mr. Counterculture. But it was fascinating to read De Spectaculis on spectacles of the Roman games.
You've just taken the next question out of my notes.
And basically described like the Las Vegas Super Bowl this weekend.
Yes,
everything from gambling to alcohol to, and this is, I don't laugh at this, but to the sex trade that's going on around.
Absolutely.
To the idolatry of the sport. And I mean, I think Tertullian needs to be held in some tension with someone like John Cassian or others that might, or even Chrysostom, that kind of hold the formative, in a positive nature of sport, the athlete of Christ motif, etc. But I was struck by, there's just not that much that's new under the sun. And even when you look at the ancient Olympics, whether it's money, whether it's violence and not compensating those who get hurt, I mean, it's all, or gladiators
I'm so glad you gave my guy Tertullian a plug.
Told Tertullian.
I think he needs a lot more.
The other thing that would be to come up to the present that's surprising, I'll bring it out in my talk tonight, is, I mean, we do live in a, right now, especially in America, this sort of polemical Catholic world. And some of this is global, but so it's like, are you a John Paul Catholic? Are you a Francis Catholic? You know, and this all plays out on social media or other insular navel gazing. But what's interesting about sport is, like, everybody from Pius X, I mean, Mr. Lamentabile, anti-modernist who also worked with Pierre Coubertin to try to bring the Olympics to Rome. Coubertin, who was like completely secular, up into Francis with Encounter, or I'll talk about John Paul and his vision, Pius XII. Like, they all see something in sport that, one, is worthy of engagement, to use the language of Vatican II, the signs of the times, but also is something that needs to be criticized. And often the language that popes use is a language of redemption, right? It's not wholly woebegone, but it also is not reached the kingdom. It has to be redeemed. And so that, in a world where we are very polarized, I think there's maybe something positive to say that sport can kind of hold, there's a thread there, at least in the modern Catholic magisterium, that I think it can carry through, but also, frankly, challenges you no matter what background you might come from.
Tell me a little more about that, because you make the argument that when sport is grounded in a healthy understanding of the purposes and the ends or the ultimate goals of human life, that sport can become a complement to what we see as some really cornerstone Catholic ideas and practices. Can you expand a little bit on that? Maybe an example or two of where one, in fact, draws upon or deepens or enriches the other?
Right. Yeah, I do think, I mean, in my theology classes, I'll often try to talk to students about the nature of freedom. And so, freedom in a stereotypical modern sense is just the freedom of choice. Give me choices, I can do what I want, I'm an autonomous individual. And I can get at that from Augustine or the religious traditions, and my students might nod, like, will that be on the test? And then go on, like, who are you imposing your values on me?
But you don't want that as a partner on the soccer field.
Right. But then, so that's what to pivot to sports, it's okay, well, let's talk about how freedom works on a sports team if every player just does exactly what they want to do. I don't want to do that training. I'm not going to do that. No, that doesn't work. Well, tell me more about that. What is that player just a slave? Are they in bondage to their coach? No, that's not right, Dr. Carney. No, well, it's sort of an entree into, okay, true freedom is a freedom for flourishing. It's communitarian. It's relational. It's not just about me being a narcissist and patting myself. And everybody in my sport classes is aware of, like, the talented athlete is a horrible teammate. Right? You can watch his highlight reel, but he undermines morale. And so, that's just one among other examples of something where it's like, okay, you got a core concept such as what's the nature of freedom. And maybe this traditional Catholic view that says, yes, God wants you to be free, but the way forward, again, through relationship relationship, even through boundedness, through accepting rules, and then also still allowing for creativity and freedom within those boundaries. And I think sport maybe allows young people to get that more than just maybe a traditional theological debate. So.
I mean, sport seems to be one of the few places in which there's a broadly shared deference to expertise that, at least in Western cultures, is increasingly held as suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Who are you to tell me what to do? I've done my own research on the internet, except when it comes to people who excel in sports and surgeons. You know,
right.
We defer to someone who's going to cut us open to say, well, I read a book. Why can't I do it? No, I don't want you with my surgeon. But it's a curious carve out from, you know, some long term cultural trends that have made any claims of experience or expertise or credibility based upon competence.
Right.
You know, kind of a sham democratization of everybody's their own expert.
Right.
Otherwise, all the refs would be murdered. Referees would be killed everywhere, not just in Brazil.
Right. Yeah, and I think that's true. Although,
apologies to Brazil.
If you look at fan boards or you listen to talk radio, which I don't encourage listeners to dive too deep into that world, but you'll see that there is though still what you're discussing. I mean, this kind of culture of like, I know better than everybody. How could the coach do that? You know, so and so they should run him out of here, you know, and all. But with that being said, I think there is still a kind of meritocracy in sport that partly goes to this just bare sense of winning. And I think the measurability of that, that I think does allow people to, sometimes for worse, but sometimes for better, to kind of defer to the expert or the talented athlete or the other, because as a fan, they feel like they're part of that and they can succeed. But boy, I mean, if you don't, as somebody coming from Nebraska, I mean, to see how Scott Frost, the football coach in Nebraska, was welcomed, and then to see how he was sent off, like the people, can quickly turn on you. So
there's something about Palm Sunday that resonates in a lot of sports fandom.
Right.
You know, Hosanna this week and adios
next week.
Now, you raised a point that I think is worth circling back on. Like any part of society, sports can lose their way.
Right.
What are some of the particular problems with sports as you survey things today? I mean, there's massive corruption in something like FIFA with a rich and long legacy of bribery associated with deciding what country gets to host the World Cup, you know, and the Olympics,
right.
You know, going to whichever country lays out the most money to impoverish its people.
Right.
There's this ugly sort of nationalism that I associate with the financial ties between the U.S. sports leagues, the broadcast partners, and the Pentagon.
Right.
Which has whole divisions dedicated exclusively to promoting the values and the image of the armed forces through sports venues and through association with the values put forward by sports and so on, rather than talking about ideologies of power and war making, which are a tougher sell sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see some of the neuralgic points where sports institutions or sports movements have just really gone off into the weeds?
Yeah. I mean, in addition to what you said, I do think the culture of youth sport and the monetization of that is a huge problem. There's been this massive explosion, even just in the last 5 years, of youth sports clubs, kind of the pay-for-play model, where it could be upwards of $600, even $1,000 for a young person to play. A lot of it's not even about talent. It used to be I'm, you know, distinctively middle-aged, but I remember growing up in soccer and thinking, okay, well, that guy's better. So he's better than me. Okay, he's on that travel team. Now it's like, that guy's parents are richer. That's why he's... So I think sometimes this has also become exploitative, even with those of lower income status, because so much money is going into that and people are starting leagues all over the place, just trying to. So I think that's a significant problem. And I think it leads into this weird kind of parental attitudes about where, as I mentioned with this friend of mine earlier, you know, parents have a kind of sense of boundaries often in areas, but when it comes to sports, there's no boundaries, right? It's like, because you have boundaries over religious practice, you have boundaries over their boyfriend or girlfriend, you have boundaries over this. But when it comes to sport, it's just like double down. And I don't know if it's like...
What does that come from? Is that from parents living vicariously through their children? Is it trying to monetize their children's ability for their own long-term security?
The last one is interesting because you'll listen to parents say things such as, well, like as long as this pays off with a scholarship. And at least at Creighton, unless you're a men's basketball player and maybe a women's volleyball player, there won't be much of a scholarship. Maybe you're a men's soccer player. Maybe you get a third of a scholarship. Okay. Like, that's not nothing. But so I think there are these. And then, of course, if you even get a scholarship, right? And even in these money sports, we're talking roughly maybe 1% of high school athletes play D1,
Division one. Those are the most.
Right. That's sort of elite, the elite level. But if you want to take it globally, a lot of times the whole idea, well, I'll play and then I'll get into a club in Europe. It's like, okay, well, the chances of doing that, the amount of money you have to put forward is absurd. So they're just, I do think human beings are competitive people. And I think that there's this, that's one thing we try to get into in the book. Like, there is something joyful about winning. It's just really exhilarating. I'm a St. Louis Cardinals fan, which I know I'm in Chicago, and that's, and luckily you're, as a Christian, you're called to love your enemies and do good to those who hate you. So, but I still think about the 2011 World Series and Game 6, and the Rangers are surely going to win this. And then it was like miraculous, Lance Berkman and David Freese and all. So I think there's something deep in our humanity that resonates with this. And I've seen that with my own kids. I mean, my kid winning this, and I just feel so great, right? And so, but what I've seen even in some of these film clips I'll do with students, if you look carefully at the young person, their face is often kind of neutral or even kind of up and down. And then they'll flash to the parent in the stands, and the parent's like, has this kind of maniacal look in their eyes. And
do you see this outside of Europe and North America? Do you see it in, it takes different forms?
That's a good point.
Is it an economic exigency? That the joke being that Africa won the World Cup last time. African athletes play for France. But that, in otherwise unpromising circumstances, that becomes a ticket out that fuels its own kind of a youth culture that's not necessarily serving something useful.
Right. Yeah. Just your first comment makes me laugh, because during the 2018 World Cup, I had a good friend of mine who was a priest from Burkina Faso living in the U.S. And I said, well, I'm sorry that your team's not in it. And I'm sorry that, he said, I'm sorry all the Africa teams are out. He said, oh, no, we're not all out. I said, what are you talking about? He's like, no, France is still there.
Yeah.
But to go to your
colonialism being
your deeper question, I don't want to speak for a global context I can't speak fully for, I do think there is this hope for opportunities, but at least what I saw when I lived in Uganda was also a certain realism among particularly parents that sometimes sport is something you should do for a while, but then you kind of need to get a real job. As a priest I knew said to a young man who played a lot of soccer, okay, when are you gonna stop playing these kids games, and kind of get on with your life? I think my sense is there's maybe a little more balance, because one of the downsides and what's not always talked about, whether it's in the developing world or whether it's in the U.S., is that money is often the ticket to these other opportunities. If you don't have money, a significant, roughly 25% of families in the U.S. whose families make less than $50,000, their kids aren't playing sport at all. And 90% of families that make over $100,000, their kids are playing sport. And so sometimes people from lower income brackets, whether globally or here, there is a sense, listen, there's a limit to this, you need to move on. And sometimes I think it's actually in the upper income brackets that kind of people can continue to sort of dance this dream, because, well, if it doesn't work out, we'll help you here, we'll put money into this, and we'll just keep throwing money at it until it works out. So
it's an interesting question you raise, because you're talking about capitalism. You're talking about the commercialization of sport, but really you're talking about economic processes that work more broadly, situating sport as one industry within a larger set of relationships. And that's not always explored in a lot of this literature, the modest amount of it that I'm familiar with. How do we think through that in a useful way?
Right. No, you're right. I mean, there's a whole world of sports marketing, sports business. even in my university, it's a big field of study. And what I find interesting is, you're exactly right. I mean, these sports teams bring so much to people. It's like similar to military bases, as you mentioned earlier, and they're big revenue streams, but there's very, very little oversight. And so, for example, there's little to no empirical evidence that the construction of stadiums on the public dollar has done much of any good in terms of actually making up the hundreds of millions of dollars, nor does it really help develop communities, you know, and yet there's this free pass. I mean, Americans will go on and on about welfare moms and all this, all right, the subsidies. And then when it comes to sport, they just free pass, put it in. And
these are our billionaires,
right,
that need our help.
That's right. That's right. And I think part of it, again, goes back to this emotional sense of my identity is caught up in this team. This is kind of who we are. Therefore, I'm willing to look the other way to put that all in. And in a healthy way, I think a sports team can. I grew up near Washington, D.C., and in that time, times have changed, but the Redskins, I mean, they held everybody together politically, racially. I mean, but it can also lead to just a complete lack of oversight, no checks or balances, and just a pretty skewed economic world when you think about who's actually benefiting from this and who's not. So
when you talk about identity, then you're already back in the middle of a Christian conversation.
That's right.
You're talking about discipleship and identity, allegiances, dispositions, and so on. Tell me more about how, as the church engages those things, that it can do so without itself becoming co-opted. I mean, I think one of the challenges in reading some past experiences is an undue confidence that churches or religious movements can move into this sector,
right,
and then just by their being there, they can transform,
right,
these things, when in fact, they're the ones who are transformed.
That's right.
Who become what it is they initially sought to,
right,
form, purify, uplift, improve, what have you.
Right.
So that you have religiously affiliated institutions that look like the most rapacious marketers.
Right.
The, who are willing to hold communities or local units of government hostage for benefits.
Right. No, and you're right. I think, I mean, I will speak generally sympathetically to the papal tradition on sport this evening, but I do think one could critique it for being a little bit overly optimistic about what you just said. Well, if the church moves in, or people go into sport, and then the culture of encounter, I mean, it can get a little platitudinous at times, and maybe not take seriously enough the deep sort of
Catholic
human
social
sin.
Catholic social thinking overall has sometimes been accused of being a little overly optimistic,
right,
and naive in its view of what politics means.
Right. So I would, I guess, as an initial response, it doesn't necessarily solve the global issue, but I think to go back to the formation question, I mean, forming your kids or your church community to practice their faith, right, and to be serious and not reactionary or, their weird kinds of religiosity come up. But I think if you're substantive and serious, you can see, as a Creighton basketball player who spoke to my class a couple of years ago said, I'll leave him anonymous, but a very successful player, was a starter on our team. And, he was an evangelical Christian. He said, I love basketball, but that's not my primary identity. I'm a follower of Jesus Christ, and that's who I am. And if the game doesn't go, the game doesn't go. But his point was, don't let your whole identity be caught up in whether you score 20 points tonight, or what happens with your fan base or your social media likes. And I think in a healthy way, a Christian identity, a sense that God loves you not because you've earned a starting spot, but because of who you are, of just who God is, that the church community needs to be open, not just to, those who pay to get in or those who earn a spot, but to all. I mean, all these things I think are healthy, but I think we need to be more intentional about naming the good of sport, but also not just being naive about, well, every virtue in sport just maps onto a Christian framework, because there's a lot of, there's going to be tensions there. And I think if you can do that, you can then engage in the world of sport, see the good of it, but not over-engage where it becomes, again, another kind of idolatry.
One of the most important sections of your book deals with failure. With losing. Now, rather uncharitably, before you made reference to your regional baseball team as a youth with a very successful tradition of winning, as opposed to the Chicago Cubs, the baseball team of my youth, who endured a 108-year long losing streak that you reminded me of so helpfully there. One could argue that being a Cub fan might be a morally superior position, because we are acquainted with the cross.
Right. right.
And we are acquainted with the oozes.
You know,
when Tolkien refers to this world as being basically the long losing.
That's right.
You know, talk to me about this.
Yeah.
Because I think it's a really important part of your reflection that deserves a lot more attention.
Well, I will say to these Cubs fans here, I hope you appreciated that in the epilogue of the book, we did talk about the North Siders. I felt like that was a real gesture on my part, you know, to reach out. So. But no, in all honesty,
that was largesse from Steven.
I think one of the problems sometimes in sport is also a kind of a superstition that could come in that's really all about winning and avoiding pain and failure, and is not the same thing, I think, as a genuine ritual encounter with God. So we talk about that some, but sometimes what you see even with athletes, and I try not to be overly harsh because part of me thinks it reflects their own spirituality and their piety, but this kind of like, I've just won the championship, or like, I just want to thank my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. I would think that Lord and Savior was crucified on a cross. Like, it would make more sense to thank him after you just got your butt kicked, you know, than when you're winning, because Christ meets us the most in our pain and suffering, not in our triumph. So, but what we found, you know, both in our work with students and some of that comes through in the writing, is that young people, high school, college students, this is not a forced thing at all. I mean, they may not get, you know, some of the things I'll teach them about genocide in Rwanda or about sort of historical things. Well, they do get, like, I was on the sports team. It was the most important thing in my life when I was 16. And then my knee blew out and that was the end of my career. And that was like everything I was, right? It's beyond an injury, that my whole identity. And some of them, you know, in a healthy way, like I realized, okay, I had to be more than the athlete. I had to grow in that. Others, it's like, I'm still working through that. Some of them, like I played through high school. We got to the state championship and we lost, right? And that was it. I mean, for 4 years, we tried to get there. Or I'm in college now and this sport organized everything for me. And now it's gone. Or I really, really wanted to be on this team and I trained and trained and trained and I got cut and the coach's kid got the spot, right? And so, and on one level you could say, oh, yeah, but compared to political violence, it doesn't matter. Yeah, and you want to be fair. Like, you getting cut from your team is not the same thing as what's going on in Gaza. But at the same time, I think that touch of suffering, God's in that. What does that mean, right? And so we try to talk about a Paschal pattern, you know, of the part of the Christian story is about life, it's about death, it's about rebirth. But rebirth is not as simple as, you know, I just came back and won the championship, right? The crucified and risen Christ doesn't even look the same. Like, something has fundamentally changed and transformed. And so, and I think it sometimes takes a while, because I think the general narrative in American culture, and maybe this is in other parts of the world too, is, well, you just come back and then you win, right? But that's not always the case. Sometimes you come back, but it's transformed and maybe you've put things in perspective. And I think that's what we call the kind of Paschal, almost the redemption experience, that I think for a lot of young people, again, they're 20 years old, but they've had that in sport. And I think they can kind of latch on to it. So.
You suggest that a Catholic understanding of sport has implications even beyond the level of individuals or local communities, up to and including matters of international cooperation, accord, discord, and so on. At one point, you make mention that it's possible that it could have a role to play in matters of war and peace, building a culture of inclusion across the ugly ditches of nationalism and race and more. That sounds an awful lot to ask of what are often children's games. But you've got an ally in that position.
Uh-huh.
You've got somebody named Pope Francis.
Right.
What's going on there?
Yeah, no, I do think that, and you see these initiatives all over. I'll speak about some of them tonight, but whether it's in Africa, in Central America, in Northern Ireland, but where often people's love of sport allows them to be together in a way across the kind of sectarian lines or political lines that might have been dividing them. And so, you know, one of the principles of reconciliation in that is that you don't always talk about what divides you. Like,
yeah.
If your conflict is about religion, maybe don't talk about religion, right? All the time. Or if your conflict is about politics. And so I think the sport provides a way for people to form a different type of relationship with someone, an identity. And I think Pope Francis sees that. And he talks a lot about how encounter kind of allows us to cross boundaries that might not be there, to work with other people in a team setting that makes us collaborate, to even compete with others that might be our opponents, mm-hmm. but to not try to exterminate them, right? So to learn how to struggle. I do think we need to be careful. And you mentioned earlier World Cup or the Olympics. I mean, often when you get to the international level, there's a lot of other factors that are going to shape this. And I think we want to be, I think those initiatives, if they're most successful, this will be something I talk about tonight, but tend to be local.
Yeah.
I think of an example in Western Rwanda, where there's tremendous tension over ongoing conflict in Eastern Congo and Rwanda's meddling in that. But the local churches started a kind of cross-border soccer games. And it was one of the first times that Congolese and Rwandans kind of interacted in this setting. I think that there's real health in that, but that's not the same thing as saying, well, then suddenly we resolved the civil war and the Kivus, you know.
Peace broke out because the midfielders.
Right. And we don't want to make sport bear too much, if that makes sense.
Right, absolutely.
I think we need to be kind of, but that doesn't mean it can't do something. And so,
where do you see these discussions going in the future? What are the most important kind of things on the horizon that you think people ought to maybe keep their eyes open for?
Yeah, I think particularly on the question of migration, I mean, we're living in the midst of a massive global migration shaped by everything from climate to politics to economics. And I do think, I mean, the whole story of sport's always about migration, and it's typically migration that people favor. You know, folks in Belgium are really glad. I just went blank on his name, the Senegalese forward who played. I'm forgetting now. But like this, there's this transfer of talent, of people across these lines. And I think that increasingly could be maybe an entree in, you know, in a world where we've really doubled down on national ethnic identities, borders, walls, et cetera. I think that's also an area sport needs to be really intentional about. You know, if you think about even the story of somebody like John in Milwaukee, right? I mean, here's son of Nigerians. He's undocumented in Greece. Family's nearly thrown out, you know, barely gets a chance in the U.S. He's now one of the top five NBA players. And I mean, this is the story of migration in the world. But I think sometimes sport allows us to hear that narrative in a way, oh, this is my favorite player. This is my team, you know? And my hope is be that, well, maybe that could open us up to all the other folks who are trying to seek, you know, a new life. So that, there are other issues, but I really think, particularly with Francis's culture of encounter, that migration is and refugee questions is the big issue. So, I was thinking of somebody else, but that's all right. Yeah.
Now, I would be remiss in letting you go without making mention of the fact that we at the Center for World Catholicism and Intercultural Theology have published some of your important scholarship in another area of your strengths, that being African Catholic life and theology. In fact, in 2020, our studies in World Catholicism, which is a series of important books on the church worldwide, published your book, For God and My People, Catholic Leadership in Modern Uganda. Can you say something about the focus of that book, which itself is built around profiles of seven important leaders in the Ugandan Catholic world, and some of the issues that have lingered from that that book has found its readership?
Sure. Yeah, thank you. Thanks to your series for publishing that book. I'm very grateful. Yeah, that book grew out of an initial interest. I had spent some time in Uganda, really going back to when I was a student, so off and on over now close to 20 years. And I kept running into priests and sisters and others I remember this first priest I worked with when I was a student, and, you know, all these women are in the back of his pickup truck. And I'm like, Father Joe, what's going on? He's like, oh, we're going to the bank. It's like, okay, well, what are they doing? Well, we're getting some micro loans. It's like, okay, why don't you break that down?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, okay, so this priest is saying mass and he's taking people to get micro loans. And then, you know, I went on a research trip to Congo about a decade ago. The bishop had built the only road that was functioning in the community. And so I thought, well, this is really interesting, because in the culture I come from, it's not this, I mean, in the history of America, there's been a lot of religious engagement in the social sphere, but it's, especially in the 21st century, it's either controversial or it's kind of under the radar. And so part of what I try to do in this book is to look at, you know, how are these leaders working out of a Catholic theological vision? How are they working out of their own personal faith? But what kind of social contributions are they making that particularly reflect some of the key themes in Catholic social thought? And often doing it not in an intentional, which is what a scholar would do, like, no, at the principle of subsidiarity. But they're just doing it organically. And they range from a bishop, but up down to lay women, to a Catholic sister who left her congregation to do a more radical and apostolate, almost a Dorothy Day style, on the streets of Kampala. A priest who was not only a seminary teacher, but also redid the constitution for Uganda. And then, you know, did a radio call-in show on the future of Ugandan politics. And, you know, these two missionaries who ran a Catholic radio station that did all sorts of devotional programming, but also talked about human rights and women's rights and refugee issues in the community. And so in some ways, it's also a book that tries to, through the lens of biography, to expand our imagination for what kind of local Catholic leadership can look like in Uganda, and then what kind of lessons might that have for, so that each chapter tries to end with constructive lessons for faith-based social leadership, you know, even in our own context here. So,
well, it's been a very well-received book by both readers and reviewers in Africa and North America alike, and I've encouraged everyone to check it out. It's available in hardback, paperback, electronic versions. Libraries can access it. Well, Jay, just thanks for spending time with us today. It's been an important topic, and it's maybe even been a little bit fun. Thank you for that.
I've rarely had more fun with two Cubs fans than I did today. So
the other Cubs fan being the long-suffering Marlon Aguilar, who helps run the Center for World Catholicism.
So in the spirit of encounter and dialogue, here we are.
All right. So, thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Marlon.
Now we got to pay Marlon residuals.
Near and Far is produced by the Center for World Catholicism and Intercultural Theology, a research institute focused on Catholicism around the world, with special attention to the Church in the Global South. The center is sponsored by DePaul University, a Catholic university in the Vincentian tradition in Chicago. Production assistance for Near and Far comes from Marlon Aguilar and Karen Kraft. For more information on the center and its activities, look for the Center for World Catholicism and Intercultural Theology on the web, Facebook, Twitter, Vimeo, and YouTube.